Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this week we will be talking about mental health provision across the UK, whether it's in hospitals, prisons or secure units. We'll be talking to MD, aka Phil Hammond, and Heather Mills, one of the Eye's investigative reporters. Not only that, later on we'll be talking about Dumb Britain, the part of the magazine which gives the most inspired answers given on quiz shows. Marcus Bergman will be telling us why the people who give the answers that end up in the column are actually geniuses. But first, mental health. Private Eye has been covering the gaps in mental health funding and provision across the country for some time now, and one of the things covered in the magazine is the individual stories of people who are affected by these decisions. Heather Mills is one of the Eye's investigative reporters. She covers a large number of cases like this, and one of these cases concerned a young woman called Amanda Briley. Here's Heather.
We chose to write about Amanda Briley because it's a particularly tragic and awful case that showed that even when a family or a young person has managed to access mental health services, and perhaps they go somewhere where the family might think their young relative is safe, that actually they're not, because the provision, even in these mental health hospitals, is just not good enough. It's understaffed, under-resourced, and quite often then just not suitable for the mental health condition or illness that people have. So, for example, with Amanda Briley, she was a 20-year-old severely autistic woman, and she was being held in a unit that was absolutely not suitable for anyone with autism. She was in a wing that was brightly lit, that was noisy, and that kind of stimulation for her, you know, was unbearable. And she was in there because there was no other suitable accommodation available for her. And the real tragic thing is that she was on a waiting list for a unit that would have been able to take her, but it only had 4 beds for women. And there wouldn't have been a vacancy until 15 months after she killed herself.
And she killed herself in the unit itself after returning to it for a brief break at Christmas time.
Yes, she had a very brief break with her family. They knew when she was going back into the unit, it was being run by Leicestershire Partnership Trust. They knew that she would be particularly vulnerable when she went back in.
One of the things you wrote in the story is that she was placed only under hourly observation, even though she had previously made attempts to kill herself, and that she should have been under constant observation, or at least more frequent than hourly.
Yes, she should have been constantly watched, and she wasn't. And she managed to kill herself some time later, taking herself off to the bathroom and fashioning a ligature and hanging herself. And what's identified in so many of these sad cases, usually of suicide or misadventure, is a lack of staff, lack of trained staff, lack of resources. It turns up time and time again. Poor training sometimes.
Yeah, and inefficient procedures in place to ensure people's safety.
Yep. Quite often poor management, you know, nobody actually taking responsibility for trying to move somebody on into more suitable accommodation. I mean, people just falling through gaps in the service.
What it seems to be is that the service is just overwhelmed by demand and by lack of resources to meet that demand.
Yeah. Low morale quite often is a factor, and not surprising if you're, you know, not being fully backed up and you're trying to cope and you have no support.
Heather Mills. Another writer who covers mental health for the Eye is MD, aka Phil Hammond, who writes the Medicine Balls column. I asked him how much progress has been made recently across the NHS.
We've turned over the stone of mental health problems to the extent that at least we're recognising how much further we need to go to have this famous parity of esteem between physical and mental health, which we've promised for a while. In fact, it was made illegal to discriminate between mental and physical health in times of resource allocation in the Health and Social Care Act. But the reality is, because we've lived through so much austerity, it's still extremely difficult for people to access mental health services, particularly young people, particularly the homeless, but also adults. And you're in that ludicrous situation that although we're supposed to be championing prevention, in many services they tell you to go away until you're really, really, really mentally ill before they'll offer you any treatment. So we're not intervening early and preventing. We're waiting for people to hit crisis because we haven't actually got the resources to do all the prevention we need. But generally, I think mental health care, I think it accounts for about a quarter of all overall activity in health and social care. It gets a tiny fraction of the budget. So a lot of people with physical conditions like cancer will also have big mental health issues. But what isn't often realized is that people with mental health issues often die 20 years younger. People who are homeless on average die 30 years before the average. But even when they have mental health issues, they often die of physical illnesses because often physical symptoms are dismissed as part of their mental illness, etc. So in an ideal holistic world, we probably wouldn't differentiate between mental and physical illness. We would treat people holistically and we'd address all their needs. But we have this sort of artificial distinction between mind and body. And at the moment, body is getting far more resources than mind.
So that's extraordinary because people who have physical problems are prioritized over people who have mental health problems, unless you've got mental health problems, in which case your physical symptoms may also be dismissed as another aspect of your mental problems.
Yes, I mean, you're far more likely to die prematurely if you have a mental illness, but of things like heart attacks and strokes and diabetes and other things as well, because maybe you struggle to articulate your symptoms, maybe you struggle to come forward to have your preventative checks and to monitor your diabetes. I mean, there's a whole host of stuff, but occasionally, I guess some of your symptoms are dismissed as anxiety or chest pain, whereas in fact it might be angina.
There was a report in 2016, a government report, about how mental health services were coping, or not coping, rather. Mm. And that was to do with the length of a wait for an appointment. It was to do with the number of people who were being sectioned under the Mental Health Act. Mm. And all of these symptoms, as you've written about in Medicine Balls, were getting worse. Has much changed since this report came out?
I think there are two issues there. When you look at the causes of the causes, we know most health is socially determined. So your life chances, your life circumstances, poverty, etc. So if you have a lot of austerity, which is what we've had pretty much since 2010, I don't think the uncertainty about Brexit has particularly helped people's mental health either. But the social determinants are getting stronger and there are more of them because we've lived through that austerity. So there's more mental illness out there and therefore we're struggling even more to cope. So
when you say social determinants, sorry, what do you mean by that?
Your health is written in the stars pretty much from the moment sperm meets egg. If you're brought up in a healthy womb for the first 9 months of your life without any cigarette smoke or drugs or whatever, your entire outlook over the course of your life is much better than if you have toxins in the womb. And then when you're a young child growing up, your health is pretty much determined by how many adverse childhood experiences you suffer. So if you're brought up in poverty or you experience domestic abuse or you're abused yourselves, that affects your physical and mental health for life. So very early on, the die is cast. And most mental illnesses manifest themselves in childhood. So by the age of 14, 15, 16, and then there are peaks in teenagers, a lot of self-harm, a lot of anxiety, a lot of depression. So you really need to get in early to try to prevent it. Now, if there's more austerity and there's more poverty, there's lots of childhood poverty out there, the various reports saying that 400,000 children don't have their own bed to sleep in, for example, then that's going to affect both physical and mental health, and that casts a long shadow. It can last for life if we don't address it early.
This sounds purely financial, but it must create much greater costs further down the line as well.
It does, and for example, if a young person has a chronic physical or mental illness, or often both, then often the mother gives up work to look after them. So there's a massive economic impact that affects the entire family, and you know, families often split up. And that's mental illness, that's learning disability, that's autism. And to be fair, the new NHS long-term plan recognises that. It's sets out very clearly the toll of mental health issues. It sets out very clearly that, you know, people affected by homelessness die on average 30 years earlier than the general population. They've recognised it, they've committed some resources. But we know it'll never be enough. Once you've had 10 years of austerity and you're only increasing the funding to 3.4% of the NHS budget, which is a little below its average over its lifetime. So although Theresa May keeps saying they're putting record funding in, it isn't actually that much in absolute terms.
So that's the increase, is it, 3.4%?
3.4% of the NHS budget and 3.1% of the overall health budget, because as well as money going to NHS England, we also have money going on training, on quangos such as NICE, and on public health. And the irony of all this is that they keep talking about preventing people getting sick in the first place, but we've slashed public health budgets. And, you know, if you don't have a good public health service, then you're storing up problems further down the line that then hit the NHS.
Many people with mental health problems end up in prison when perhaps they shouldn't be there. Here's Heather Mills again.
As we speak, there are two inquests that we know about, and probably others actually, of mental health patients. One who was being cared for supposedly in the community, who died in his supported accommodation. Another dreadful case of a young woman in a specialist unit, and those are currently taking place. And then there's another whole area of mental health where we're getting a lot of mental health deaths, and that's in prisons. And there's an inquest that has just finished about a young remand prisoner, a young man called Ryan Harvey, who had been remanded to Woodhill Prison. He was classed as a vulnerable adult. He had learning difficulties. He'd been remanded for setting fire at the family home. And he was due to have a mental health assessment in the hospital. Because of chronic understaffing, that mental health assessment never happened. And he hanged himself within 2 weeks of being in the jail. And what was quite striking in his case was that the head of the health unit said she only had four staff for 800 inmates. So how can they possibly cope with very vulnerable people going into the prison setting and getting the care and treatment that they need? I'm sure there were lots of people argue that, you know, he shouldn't have been in a jail in the first place.
Obviously, an important part of the resource problems are to do with the number of staff required. So you've written about the government promise that 21,000 specialist staff would be trained before 2021.
Yeah.
Which you said is kind of fantasy.
Which is a fantasy, but it also depends what you mean by specialist staff. So we have got some innovative programs like, you know, IAPT, which known as Increasing Access to Psychological Therapies. And that can be online, or it can be through psychologists, or it can be through lesser trained health professionals. So the low hanging fruit where you get people with less training because they're cheaper to train. We are training a few more of those, but we have glaring vacancies for senior psychologists, senior psychiatric nurses, and consultant psychiatrists. If you're a junior doctor now and you want a career that's quite fast track, I would say psychiatry is the place to go because there are so many vacancies. They'll probably fast track you to a consultant fairly quickly. So yes, there is. You know, we are increasing numbers of bodies on the ground, but in fact, the expensive specialist staff who need to deal with the really complex cases, we still have big vacancies in many parts of the country. And I think they looked at 9 out of 10. So just in CAMHS, which is the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, I think 9 out of 10 of their staff said they didn't have sufficient staff and it was affecting the quality of care. And a recent study by, I think, the PAC, the Public Accounts Committee, said, I think only 3 in 10 children were getting the mental health treatment they needed. So that's pretty staggering. And again, they repeated this story of people being told, come back when you're even sicker than you are at the moment, which isn't really how you should do prevention.
So all of these problems, you know, they're telling people to go away until they are really at crisis point, presumably in the hope that some of them will give up or some of them will get better of their own accord. Is that the aim?
It is. And what's interesting is that it's, you know, I have a relative who has a very long-standing mental health problem, and she's never going to be cured, but she suffers from recurrent suicidal thoughts that are deeply unpleasant. But the service now only offers you a short course of cognitive behavior therapy or a short course with a community psychiatric nurse, and then that's it. They don't provide ongoing care for people with chronic mental illnesses that are slowly burning out over the years but are likely never to be cured. So it's basically you've got a short course of something which I hope cures you, or you go your own way. But if you're suddenly really suicidal and there's a crisis, you can call the crisis team. And that's going to be going through NHS 111 soon. But so there's sort of nothing in between. You either get better on a short course, we'll see you when you're in crisis and you pitch up in casualty suicidal, but we don't have anything long-term for people with long-term mental health issues, and there are lots of those out there.
And the short courses can be as short as, you know, four half-an-hour-long sessions, one a week for 4 weeks,
yes.
And then you're out on your ear again.
They are. I mean, there are online. There are lots of apps. I mean, it's the future. Matt Hancock, the new health secretary, is desperately keen to get everyone to use apps. And there are lots of apps out there to help people with mental health issues to do an online version of cognitive behavior therapy or mindfulness or acceptance and commitment therapy. But it's never as powerful as seeing a qualified psychologist or psychiatrist face to face. So we're sort of doing the cheapest possible option, but people aren't having the therapeutic relationship of meeting someone that they trust and seeing them regularly because we just don't have the resources to do that.
Presumably that is an expensive treatment because it requires long-term and ongoing treatment in many cases.
It is expensive treatment, but, not to treat is even more expensive because the psychological toll, as I said, not just of a psychological or psychiatric condition that can stay with you for life, but also the effects has on your family, your employment prospects, the hit to the economy, the vast majority of days off sick because of mental health issues, particularly in the NHS, rather ironically, where work-related stress is a sort of endemic level. So although, yes, it is expensive to treat mental health issues properly, it's, the longer-term toll is far greater. But of course, politics has traditionally been about short-termism. So again, it's quite nice to have the idea of a long-term NHS plan, and it does make some great recommendations. But, since I qualified, I've had a dozen plans, and you could have cut and pasted many of the recommendations out of previous plans, and they haven't quite happened. I've had all these plans, we're still 100,000 staff short in the NHS. And what the long-term plan doesn't do is a manpower plan for anything, but, particularly not mental health. It doesn't talk about shortages in staff. Rather, it hopes that we'll all have digital consultations online through apps and that will sort us out. And I rather doubt that, particularly for the complex cases.
The government has promised $20.5 billion over the next 5 years to boost health services generally, to ring-fence $2 billion of that for mental health. But as some of these cases graphically illustrate, that isn't going to go anywhere near to filling the gap in staffing, funding, suitable accommodation for all of these people who are currently falling through this dreadful gap in provision.
Because the staff are so dedicated, there is truly extraordinary care going on out there. But, we shouldn't say that the NHS is the best in the world or a world-class service. It's an average service with average funding. Has some absolutely brilliant care going on there, but there's lots of mediocrity. But even more so, there's lots of gaps in care. Lots of people with mental health issues, again, young people being shunted around the country because they can't get mental health care in their own area. There is a renewed focus on things like suicide, something, again, I've written in about the eye because my dad took his life. And that's something that's very personal to me. And that is coming down a bit. It's still far too common, but suicide rates are coming down a bit. But suicide, particularly amongst men, is still the commonest cause of death in men under 50. And although it's come down a bit, it's still higher than a lot of other countries. But again, I'd say we have a lot of inequality and social injustice in this country, and I think that really pushes it because men often feel that they should be the providers, they should be able to care for their families, and they often feel like failures if they're not able to do that, to fulfil what they see as their duties of being a man. And another thing is they're less likely to talk about it. So what we do know about suicidal thoughts is that they generally pass in time. You can have the most overwhelming suicidal thought, but if you've got some strategies for dealing with it, such as try to do 10 things to just take the edge off it a little bit, but, go to casualty if they don't work, you find that they pass with time. So women are much better at coming up with strategies for dealing with suicidal thoughts, whereas men are often likely to sit on their own in the car and act on them.
Is there still, do you think, a stigma or a difficulty that men have in acknowledging or asking for help about suicidal thoughts?
Yeah, I think there is. I think it's getting better. And there are things like the Zero Suicide Alliance, which was founded by a dad whose son took his life, that provides training available for everyone. And I'd encourage people to go and have a look at that. But it's the same as how, we should all learn how to do cardiopulmonary resuscitation, because one day somebody's going to drop down and the heart's going to stop and you're going to look a bit stupid if you don't know how to do the basics. But it's also this, occasionally somebody will confide in you or they will just burst into tears and look awful. And you've got to have the courage to ask them about suicidal thoughts and talk them through it. And there's good evidence if we do that, we become emotionally competent and able to have those difficult conversations. You can talk people down from it and encourage them to seek help. So although we put a lot of onus on the NHS, I think there's a lot of we can do as people and communities to reduce the risk and to talk people away from that particular course of action.
That was Dr. Phil Hammond, and before that you heard Heather Mills. The website that MD mentioned, in case it is useful, is zerosuicidealliance.com. Now we turn to Dumb Britain, the column which strikes fear into the hearts of quiz contestants across the country. Here's Marcus Berkman, the man behind the column, explaining exactly what it is.
These are real answers to real questions on real quiz shows that people have sent in because they're very silly. They're put in for their humorousness. They're not there to illustrate that the world is full of thickies. Although, obviously, if you do watch as many quiz shows as I do, you realise that the world is indeed full of thickies. But it's not specifically supposed to do that. It's supposed to be make you laugh.
A lot of the answers are chosen because they're very apt or they're inapt in exactly the right way. So, for example, who formulated the laws of gravity after watching an apple fall from a tree at his Lincolnshire home? Contestant answers, Einstein.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think the reason that this thing works is that whenever we read this, that we can imagine the person sitting in the chair thinking, I know that the answer is Isaac Newton, but then hearing your mouth saying Einstein. I have been there myself on quiz shows, and I have done that. And you just think, you say the first thing that comes into your head, and it's the wrong thing.
How did you get into Dumb Britain in the first place?
Ian had got somebody else to start the column, and he whoever it was did it for a few months, and it wasn't really working. So he asked me to take it over, and I've been doing it for somewhere in the region of 20 years. And I, in fact, walking here this evening, I was thinking, it must be coming up for a 20-year anniversary any week now, so I've got to go home and look it up.
Are they all based on shows that you've watched yourself? Do you genuinely watch every quiz show going and you make a note of the best answers?
No, I don't know, because you have people who sent them in, and there's no need to watch. I watch a handful, and whenever I watch them, there's very rarely anything as stupid as this. And you'd have to watch all of them all the time, and you know, they would be intolerable. But and the other thing is that I have a couple of spies who work for the shows who send me them.
No.
Yes. If anybody else wants to be one of my spies, do send me an email, because I'd love to add you to my list. But they're very useful, because then you know if it comes from a spy, then it's absolutely genuine.
Are there shows which yield especially good seams of wrong answers?
Yes and no. I would say that The Weakest Link was particularly good because of its very sort of belligerent approach to everyone, and everyone was there to be humiliated. And the first round of questions in The Weakest Link were all very, very simple. And so if you have a very, very simple questions are the meat and drink of this column. And more recently, The Chase and Tipping Point, both on ITV, are two of the column's favourites.
There is something about the pressure of a quiz show which produces answers which are not just wrong, but kind of brilliantly wrong.
Yes. Well, that's the fun of it. And the point is, some of these questions, you have to really think about how anyone is actually going to come up with any of these things. So, for example, one of my favourites, and this is from, the 70s or the 80s, and we put this on the cover of a Dumb Britain book, and it was on Radio Merseyside, and the presenter said, what was Hitler's first name? And the caller said, Heil. It's the imaginative process that comes up with these amazing answers that is what we love.
So you presumably reject the idea this is just a snobbish exercise, because the name Dumb Britain, it does imply a certain kind of
it does, but I inherited the column name, and I've never particularly liked it, and I've actually spent 20 years trying to justify it, and because people do get cross about it, and I get letters regularly from people saying Dumb Britain, you know, sneering at people getting things wrong. Well, yes and no.
Have you suffered a catastrophic collapse on a quiz show? Because you do a lot of quizzes. I don't think the readers may know this.
No, they don't. And, well, I have a sideline, and I'm a quiz master, so I do lots and lots of quiz mastering all over the southeast of England all the time, and do about probably one a week, 50 a year roughly. But I've been on a couple of quiz shows, and I went on 15-1, which I was completely obsessed with in the 90s, totally obsessed with. And I think it was on two or three times on different occasions. Two of the times I came up with the most catastrophic errors. The first time I was on, it was who was the Sun King of France?
Okay.
And I came up with the wrong Louis, although my brain knew which Louis it was, but my mouth definitely said the wrong Louis. Okay. So, and there was another one I was on, and I needed to answer one question to win the show. And William G. Stewart read out the dictionary definition of a stenographer.
Okay.
He could have said, you know, what are those two things on the end of your legs with five toes on each? But and I wouldn't have known the answer, because my brain had gone. So I'm sympathetic to people who go on these things and make complete fools of themselves.
I think we can all empathise. There are times in all of our lives. And I still think of questions I've got wrong in quizzes.
Well, absolutely all the time. Did you know that in 2005, Ian Hislop and Christopher Booker and Francis Ween and I went on University Challenge the Professionals as the Private Eye team?
I did not know that.
There were 10 shows, and the top four scoring teams went on to the semi-finals. And ours was the last of the main 10 to be recorded, and we had to get 210 points to go on, which is a lot of points. And we started amazingly. We were playing Debrett's, and we started like a train. And Hislop, Booker and Ween, they're brilliant. They know everything, and they were fantastic, and I got one or two things, and we were working really well. And then we started ballsing things up. And we were leading, I think, 135-15. And in the end, I think we only scored 150 points and we didn't go through. And we all fell away. And one of the bonus rounds was Ian's special subject in finals at university. And he got none of them right. And he said afterwards, he says, well, have I got news for you for 15 years? And that was much more stressful than any of those. So it happens to everybody.
There are some absolute classic. You know, a witch battle in 1805 was a combined Spanish and French fleet under Admiral Villeneuve defeated by a British fleet under the command of Lord Nelson, contestant Hastings.
Just brilliant.
Fabulous.
What it demonstrates to me is that people know nothing about anything. You know, I mean, for example, geography is a particularly disastrous. So this is Graham Gardner on Beat the Nation, Channel 4, a number of years ago. What is the highest mountain in England? Contestant after long pause, Everest. And then Anne Robinson on The Weakest Link. What is the highest mountain in Scotland? Ben Watt. Contestant, Everest. And Eamon Holmes on the National Lottery jet set. Ben Nevis is situated in which mountain range? Contestant, the Himalayas. So it goes on and on and on. And the same things turn up year after, over many years. These people are making the same mistakes over and over again.
William Goldman, the Hollywood writer, his motto was nobody knows anything.
Yes.
He was talking about the film industry.
He was.
You're saying it applies universally.
I'm afraid so.
We should have some more of your favourites. You've been doing this for 20 years. There must be some which have a dear place in your heart.
Well, yes, I have several, actually, and I have a whole load of them in front of me. Family Fortunes, do you remember that?
Yeah.
With Bob Monkhouse and Les Dennis, okay. And Max Bygraves briefly in between. And that was always very good because the thought processes involved were so surreal. So, for example, name a type of fork not used for eating, Guy Fawkes. So that's not bad. And then name something sold by gypsies, bananas. Name a part of the body everyone has only one of. And first contestant said big toe. And the second contestant said wedding tackle. And the third contestant said combine harvester. Now, what's happening there? What's going on? I have no idea. I mean, combine harvester. Clearly, his mind just went. I can tell you my two all-time favourites.
Yes,
actually,
please.
Because I've been doing this a long time, and my two all-time favourites go back a long, long way. And one of them was on Radio 1, and it was Sarah Cox, and that shows how long ago it is. So it must be 15-plus years. And Sarah Cox said, complete this well-known phrase, beauty is in the eye of the... And the caller thought for a moment and said, tiger. And in fact, actually, it's better than the original. Beauty is in the eye of the tiger. It's genius. And the other one is my all-time favourite, was from The Weakest Link, again, a long time ago. And Anne Robinson said, who painted the Mona Lisa? And the contestant said, Frank Boff. Now, and Frank Boff, you know, besweated BBC breakfast host of the 80s and 90s, not a particularly famous Renaissance artist, but nonetheless, it was about 18 months later, I can remember where I was when I thought about it, and I suddenly was walking on Great Portland Street, and I suddenly realised that I knew what this was about. This guy had obviously only ever heard of one artist, who was Van Gogh. And in some way, Van Gogh and Frank Boff had become the same person. And so the intellectual process by which he came to Frank Boff was so complicated, and yet he did it in a second or two. And that's just genius.
This sounds like this could be valuable to neurological departments and research about how the brain works and how it comes up with an answer so quickly, whether or not it's the right one.
I suspect you're right.
Marcus Berkman, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That's it for another episode of Page 94. We will be back again in due course with another one, probably in 2 weeks' time, although you never can tell. Maybe it'll be less, probably not. Thanks for listening to this one, and as ever, if you'd like to read more about the stories that you've heard, they're available in a very popular magazine called Private Eye. Thank you very much. Goodbye.